The book Maximum City is about the largest city in the world, its enormous movie industry, its organized crime, its religious feuds, and how fundamentalism is affecting politics. The city is Bombay, also known as Mumbai. Author Sukedo Mehta grew up there. He left in 1977 and came back 21 years later to research his book. He spoke to criminals, policemen, prostitutes, and politicians. He even co-wrote a Bollywood musical. Mehta also has lived in London, Paris, New Jersey, Iowa City, and New York, where he is based now. He's written for the New York Times Magazine, Harper's, and The Village Voice. In his book Maximum City, which just came out in paperback, Mehta writes, "With 14 million people, Bombay is the biggest city on the planet of a race of city dwellers. Bombay is the future of urban civilization. God help us." Terry spoke to Mehta last winter.
You describe Bombay as representing the city of the future. What are the characteristics of Bombay that you think represent the city of the future?
Right. I think, Terry, that the 21st century will be dominated by these vast megacities, mostly in the developing world. The United Nations just came out with a report predicting that by the year 2030, 60% of the planet's population will be living in cities. And 2 billion people will be living in slums. Now, there's a group of cities such as Sao Paulo, Lagos, Jakarta, Kinshasa, Bombay, which are composed of, well, the definition of a megacity is more than 10 million people. But these cities have enormous numbers of people constantly coming in from the countryside and living in these vast shanty towns. They're also marked by a kind of breakdown of civic order and a constant low-level strife. So in the case of the Brazilian cities, tremendous influence by the drug gangs over the affairs of the city. And in Bombay, the underworld specializes in extortion, real estate, and film financing. And really, they've become pretty unpleasant places to live for most of the people in it. But these cities also represent hope for the people coming in from the countryside. They're a beacon of hope for the young people in the countryside. And their growth is added to because of the impoverishment of the countryside, because agriculture is less and less viable in these countries. And part of the reason for that is also the enormous subsidies given to agriculture in the developed countries. So it means that a cotton farmer or a wheat farmer in India can't get a fair price for his crops, and his son will take the first train to Bombay and join the ranks of the people in the swelling shanty towns.
You write also about when you were living in Bombay that all around people asked you for money, your driver, your maid, your friends down on their luck, strangers. How is that different from New York, where at the very least there's no shortage of strangers asking you for money?
Well, the difference is that in New York, we're not very rich. In Bombay, we were very rich because we were coming from New York. So we were at the top of the pyramid. And from all areas, they zoomed in on us. We were like a low pressure system in an area of high pressure. And it got really uncomfortable to have to continuously either bring out our wallet or refuse to bring out our wallet.
So what did you do more often, bring out the wallet or not?
Well, initially, we brought out our wallet quite a lot, and we got ripped off all the time in buying the simplest of services, till we realized that it was a form of newcomer's tax. That is, anybody who comes into a city, any city, in the first year will get ripped off. You'll get ripped off if you're coming to New York and you don't have a network and, you know, you don't know which movers to hire or you don't know where to shop for the cheapest clothes. So for the first year, it was really uncomfortable, and we spent much more money than we should have. But then as we got used to it, we realized there were ways in which we could avoid con games, for example, and know who to trust and who not to. And we discovered the best places to shop for bed sheets, computers, and oregano.
Oregano?
Well, we'd come from New York, and one thing we really missed was Italian food. So we ended up cooking a lot of Italian food at home. And I remember the heaviest item in my luggage going to Bombay was a giant can of extra virgin olive oil.
My guest is writer Suketu Mehta, and his new book is called Maximum City, Bombay Lost and Found. He grew up in Bombay and returned there for several years in the late 90s and early 2000s to live and to research this book. Seeing how Muslims and Hindus do not get along famously in Bombay now, and, you know, having researched what happened in the riots and having spoken to Hindus who describe how they killed Muslims, what is your reaction to seeing the growing role that religion is starting to play in American politics?
I lived in Iowa for 3 years, and so I've seen the growing role of the evangelical churches in the American Midwest. And if people say that much of India is a Hindu nationalist country, then by that definition, much of America is a Christian nationalist country. It's not something that, you know, I see as a welcome development, but I also see that for many of those people in the Midwest, their faith really is a reaction to the more troublesome aspects of modernity. That if they really don't know how to deal with the modern world and its changing values. And it's the same reason people in India turn to the more extreme manifestations of Hinduism or of Islam. Except in India, the trouble really happens in the larger cities, that is, in urban India, not in rural India. You'll hardly ever hear of religious riots in the countryside. And in America, certainly the values crowd seems to be concentrated in, you know, flyover country. The difference between the two countries also is that this spring, India voted out the BJP. This was the party associated with Hindu nationalism. And, you know, they were mostly voted out for economic reasons, but there was also a large section of the country which felt troubled by this increasing involvement of religion in politics. And I must admit that I was hoping that the same sort of thing would happen here, but it hasn't yet. Maybe America needs to experience a few more years of people who want to eliminate the barriers between religion and politics in public life to really know what it feels like to live with such a government.
One of the things you got to do when you were living in Bombay is to co-write a Bollywood musical called Mission Kashmir.
Right.
And how did
They're all musicals.
They're all musicals, yes. How did you get to write for Bollywood?
Well, I wanted to study Bollywood from the inside. Now, I realized early on in my stay in Bombay that, you know, I'd always grown up with Bollywood. I love the movies. And I realized that I couldn't just go around interviewing people. Most of these people are very busy. They have no time for journalists, Indian or foreign. So the only way I could really understand the making of this fascinating industry was to work in it. That is, to follow the construction of desire in these movies from the inside by making myself useful to them. So when a writer friend of mine invited me to come along to a story session that his brother-in-law, a famous movie director, was doing, you know, I came along and the director started asking me questions when he found I was a writer. And before long, I became part of the script writing team for a movie called Mission Kashmir, which is a film ostensibly about war-torn Kashmir, but with song and dance.
So you had to show the film to the censor board of India. What are the parameters for censorship in India?
All of these films are very heavily censored to a degree that would be unthinkable in the U.S. That is, you're not allowed to have nudity, you're not allowed to have open sex, you're not allowed to have swear words. So it really stifles cinema in India. And the censor board is really made up of people often who are very ignorant about cinema. They're drawn from the community, that is, respectable middle-class people, somewhat like the Texas State Textbook Commission. So I've actually sat in on meetings of the Indian Censor Board and watched them censor films on political grounds. That is, it would make the police look bad, or it would make the a particular political party look bad. And the country accepts this. So as a result, most of these Bollywood films, and even the South Indian films, they get by on lots of double entendres and innuendo and, you know, the famous wet sari scene in which the heroine will accidentally get drenched in the rain and will dance around with her sari becoming progressively more transparent. It's really quite disturbing when you're trying to get across political ideas which reflect what's happening in the country, and the censor board says that the country is absolutely not ready for this.
Where did the songs come in?
The songs, Terry, I think are the most delightful part of the Bollywood films. And there's a long tradition in India of advancing narrative through music. So you'll find this in the folk theater of the country, in the religious epics, the way they're told. They'll be singing and dancing. And the song isn't, it's not just a diversion from the plot. It actually advances the plot in many ways. And even if it doesn't, it's fine, because people come there to have a complete entertainment. You know, there's a film out right now called Veer Zara, which I'd also followed the making of, which is almost 3.5 hours long. Now, you know, most Americans would be killing themselves if they had to sit through a 3.5 hour film. But for the Indian viewer, you know, he's worked all day in the villages, and in the evening, he really wants value for his money. He wants to sit for 3.5 hours and watch these gorgeous people dance and have troubles and resolve them at the end and have, you know, families reunified. He wants it all. He wants action. He wants a bit of titillation. He wants song and dance. Because, you know, when he goes back, there isn't that much to go back for. So the films are kind of an exaggerated reality. And even the singing, you know, often the singing really escapes logic altogether. There'll be a pair of lovers. They'll be walking down Bombay Street. And the man will look at the woman and start singing, and all of a sudden they'll be magically transported to the Alpine valleys of Switzerland. And no one in the audience will blink an eyelid and think, well, this can't really happen.
So Ketu Mehta, speaking to Terry Gross in December of 2004. His book, Maximum City, has just come out in paperback.